love to sing about the moon and the June and the spring. I love to sing about a sky of blue or a tea for two, anything with a swing or two, and I love you.
Yeah. Well, man, what a beat.
Will you stop that silly beat business and listen?
All right, guys, our top three best 2D animated films. I'm going to start us off here. Number three, this one comes from the heart, McGee. It had pathos. It had high dad soup. It had the perfect cast. Talking about 1995's A Goofy Movie.
Oh, yeah.
This was a Disney Channel favorite. Favorite between me and my brother. Great songs, great performances, and it gave a dimension to Goofy that you don't normally associate with the character, as far as like the fatherhood and trying to connect with his son. This is a big popular one, I think, for kids of our generation. Did it make an impression on you, A Goofy Movie?
I think I was like a little bit. It might have been one of my many. Just like trying to be a little too cool for school.
Oh, really?
It just didn't connect with me in the same way for whatever reason.
Right.
I didn't really identify with the struggles of either Goofy or Max or whatever. It wasn't something that resonated with me too deeply.
I feel like we're going to have a lot of that going on this episode. So number two, I had to go with, and some of the sentiment of this conversation is going to be animated films for kids don't do this necessarily anymore, where it's a little more risque in tone of this film and spirit of this film. So I went with one that was similar in vein to that in my past. 1986 is The Great Mouse Detective. This is probably my introduction to Sherlock Holmes as a kid. But there were things like burlesque dances in the middle of The Great Mouse Detective. Like characters were drinking and smoking. And actually there was like some actual frightening bits in it, little bits of horror that I remember as a kid. So, and Vincent Price as Raddington, one of top 10 favorite villains of all time for me in the Disney universe. So The Great Mouse Detective, that was definitely on repeat for me as a kid. And my number one. Oh, I appreciate it. It made an impression on you.
You're right in the line with the stuff that I resonated with. Like you're saying, the darker, weirder stuff was always the stuff that, for some whatever reason, I was drawn to a little bit more.
Hell yeah. Number one's no secret with me. I don't have many perfect movies, Sean, to where even on a Letterboxd rating, I'd give something a 5. It really takes or is it a 4 or 5? Whatever it is.
Yeah,
perfect
5.
Rating, 5. It really takes a lot for me to say, like, this is, I wouldn't change anything in this.
Yeah, me and you are very similar in that way.
I don't have very many, even the films that I love and adore and respect from directors that I, you know, you stand on the shoulder of giants, you know what I mean, with work that comes after them.
Exactly.
I still could be like, well, I wish you hadn't have done this. or I would have changed just this bit.
Yeah.
For my number one pick, 1994's The Lion King. There's not a frame I would change in this movie.
That was coming, for sure.
Absolutely perfect movie in my estimation. I can't tell you how much I've watched this movie as a kid and what it inspired me to do later on in adulthood. So my number one in the best 2D animated films will always be 1994's The Lion King. Remember who you are. Go ahead, McGee. What's your top three?
So I think you'll like my number three then. I wasn't sure, but I went with Rescuers Down Under.
Oh, hell yes.
And specifically Rescuers Down Under for
Joanna!
Whatever reason. Oh my
Some
God, I can hear that echo. Yeah, exactly. Like
I love you.
I love that movie so
much. I love
both
of them. I'm not going to lie to you.
Both of them are great, but for whatever reason, that was, and maybe just because it was a little bit more like contemporary when I was a kid, where the first one was like going back and watching it.
Right.
But yeah, that the Rescuers Down Under was one that I don't even know how many times I watched. Yep. I absolutely love that movie. Yep. Probably part of the reason I'm so like was such a desert desert weirdo when I was out in California. I wonder if that's some of the roots in there.
Was it Bianca and Bernard?
Yes, for sure. Yeah. And those performances are so great. Yeah, like yeah. I
can't remember what the seagull's name was, or the rescue, like the their indie kind of character, like the Indiana Jones.
Oh yeah,
I can't remember what those guys were named, but I do remember. I love those performances as a kid.
I have like the wingspan of an albatross lodged into my memory because of that sequence. Like an albatross. So we both love that movie. We won't have to cover it on the pod, but for number two is some basic bitch. I had to go with Akira because
I like it. I respect it.
I mean, it is so cinematic, mm-hmm. so gorgeous, so just like gorgeously lush, and also a story that couldn't have told outside of animation. Like that was a story that needed to be animated. So that was like also kind of what I was trying to go for with some of these picks.
I like that.
And then number one, had to pick a Miyazaki. Had to have Miyazaki on the list somewhere. So my personal favorite Miyazaki is Princess Mononoke.
Yes.
I think I bounce back and forth. I don't think it's the best one. It's just the one that I personally probably watch the most. But yeah, we had to have Miyazaki if we're talking about 2D animation on this list somewhere.
Absolutely. Perfect choice too. Yeah,
I know that you're also a big Mononoke fan. That was one of my like ways to kind of weasel in and figure out your like how much fantasy was acceptable for you to deal with in a narrative.
Mononoke is definitely acceptable. All right, welcome to Make Me Watch. We're a couple of failed filmmakers who are forever students of cinema. And if you haven't heard, we're on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, Eric Elliott, and I'm joined by my co-host, Sean McGee. Ashante, mademoiselle, how are we?
I got my IV Guinness hooked up, and I'm ready to go.
Wait, I'm trying to get the reference.
Go ahead. He has like an IV of a wine bottle when he's at one point one of the bikers when they're hooked up to the machine.
Oh, really? One of them's a wine bottle?
They have just wine bottles hooked up to tubes that are going in their arms so while funny. They're on the machine.
I didn't catch that. I got the IVs. I didn't catch it that they were wine bottles. I like that. This is a show where Sean and I trade off forcing one another to watch our favorite films. On today's episode, I have my pick for the week, and that's 2003's The Triplets of Belleville. We're going to give our overall thoughts up top without spoiling, and then we're going to dive into the film with our world-famous segments that break down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind-the-scenes stories. So without further ado, let's get into our review of 2003's The Triplets of Belleville. Oh, you know what? This is going to be interesting. So, this is a silent film for the most part. And it's also, from what little dialogue is in the film, it's in French. So, what we're going to do is transition with what I think is the absolute banger on this score, and that's Belleville Rendezvous. Yeah. And this is a score by Benoit Charest, I think we're going with. So love this score, love this song, and we'll come in with the credits after this.
That was the main theme of 2003's The Triplets of Belleville, written and directed by Sylvain Chomet, art direction by Thierry Million, and music by Benoit Charest. Obviously this is mostly dialogue-free, so we don't have actors for the performances, but we're going to, you know, We'll get into that as we go. But all right, first up in our exit interview, we got our spoiler-free general thoughts coming up top. Starting with the titular question, Eric, why did you make me watch this?
Well, Sean, I've been in a mood lately. All right, and when I tend to get in these little dour spaces, there are a few filmmakers that I think really capture a sense of melancholy pretty well for me. And we're going to cover an artist that's in the animated space that I think does this particularly well. Now, what makes a melancholic film for me is its space. It's in the space and the dialogue. You know, it's not a dialogue heavy film, and for large parts of it, you know, it have a lack of dialogue as we have here. It's more of a vibe. It's more of a mood kind of piece. The plots don't necessarily resolve themselves, and here it does in more of a traditional way. Again, we'll say spoiler free for its resolution, but. In other films of this type, you know, they don't necessarily, you know, the guy doesn't necessarily get the girl, or the day isn't saved at the end. You kind of can feel a little plotless in areas. Melancholic animated films aren't new. There is, you know, a direct predecessor to this styling, and a somewhat of a contemporary for Sylvain Comet is Don Bluth. So the films that would, you know, be like the Land Before Time series.
Yeah,
there was
also a huge one for me.
Yeah, nice Littlefoot. There was a
oh my god, yeah.
You know, there's a loss, there's anxiety, there's fear, which were like the bedrock of those films tonally. And not that, you know, Disney didn't necessarily have, you know, Bambi's mom dying at the beginning, but it was always kind of followed by a song and something to kind of pick you up. And that they would, like, you know, the oppressiveness and just, like, you know, the sense of just. The morbid kind of sense of those films wasn't like what kind of the atmosphere. There's an atmosphere to those films.
There's a difference between the inciting action being something dramatic like that, or but like, yeah, like a Don Bluth film that's like, no, this is a meditation on loss. Like, yeah, it's a little bit different.
I'm reminded too of Charles Schulz and his Peanut characters, and they would inhabit whole personality profiles and single note psychological states. So you would have Charlie Brown, which would represent depression, and Lucy that would represent anger. Some characters would represent, you know, one or two of these things and have, you know, different shades of complexity, like Linus, Lucy's little brother, who would, you know, wisdom on one end. He would be the most wise of the peanuts, but also really codependent with his blanket and his thumb in his mouth. So there's a great duality there. There are a whole host of others to pull from. Rugrats, you know, Looney Tunes, Max Fleischer shorts. Like, that's what animation does well. Like, at its utmost and at its best when it's well done. Animated characters kind of distill and they exaggerate in ways that reality, kind of governed by physics, cannot. Do you know what I mean? So we love caricature because there's a unique dynamic of, on one hand, you can really strip so much of a person and then exemplify another bit of them that kind of just really resonates. Like, what's the essence of this, you know, person? If you have a big nose, you get drawn in that way and it's exaggerated, and some of your more, the dimensionality as you as a person gets a little bit more simplified, but there's an essence to that, you know, or an essence to you. You're kind of brought down to a very digestible form, if that makes any sense.
So totally. Like the down to the building blocks.
You know what? Yes, exactly. Something of that nature. So I wanna, while I'm in this space of how animation and its distilling of character is so well done, I want to kind of correct a little something that we said last week. Last week we released our Roadhouse episode, and there was a moment in that episode where we discussed Ben Gazzara acting out a completely unhinged moment where he's driving in and out of the lane of a car, or in and out of the lane of a highway, singing a song. And we kind of chalked it up to it just being like cartoonish, which I feel is a little wrong of me, particularly coming from a background of animation, because I regret doing so, because I made the mistake that I think plenty of laymen do, myself included, as I just, you know, admitted to last week, where we kind of dismissively kind of cast aside like the brilliancy of that distilling character that animation does so well, because some of the more outsized and wacky things about animation are the things that you remember. Some of the rules and the internal logic that govern these worlds and make these things believable, or at least in their own spaces, is what the brilliance kind of comes from for me. So an example for that would be the Coyote and the Roadrunner. Chuck Jones is a famed Warner Brothers animator and did a lot to kind of craft the personalities of these characters that we see today. He had rules for how you write Wile E. Coyote and how you write the Roadrunner that were a big thing in his autobiography and certain animators kind of, you know, when they teach you in school, like rules to kind of build your world around. I'll just give you a few of them. So number one, the Roadrunner cannot harm the coyote except by going meep meep. So we're always on the, you know, Roadrunner's side because he's never physically doing something to the coyote. Number two, no outside force can harm the coyote, only his own ineptitude or failure of the Acme products. Trains and trucks were the exception from time to time. So it was always by the coyote's hand that, you know, something went wrong, mm-hmm. or the product itself that he brought, you know, failed on him. Number three, the coyote could stop at any time if he were not a fanatic. So there's obviously he could do something else with his time and in his world, but he's so obsessed with catching the Roadrunner, and that's where you derive the comedy from. And just number five, the Roadrunner must stay on the road for no other reason in that he's a Roadrunner. So whenever we present the Roadrunner, always on a road.
Interesting.
These kind of rules that you don't necessarily as an audience or as a child know hand to hand, but you internally ingest it. And when you kind of base something around these rules, the internal logic works for you. So mm-hmm. you can't have outsized rockets that don't go off or blast off later, or the coyote doesn't realize he's in midair until he looks down and then gravity then takes a hold because he's noticed. Because there's rules to how this world works. When I see that Ben Gazzara film, what I'm bucking up against is there's no rules to this character. Like there's nothing that makes sense that we've seen or presented beforehand. It's just a lot of different bits, you know, there's nothing that kind of unifies what's going on here. So that's the most remarkable aspect I feel of Sylvain Comey's work, is his ability to kind of capture the essence of a being and not only give it like the carnival-esque exaggeration, but also kind of capture the essence in their movement of that exaggeration. So how characters will physically move in these spaces. And no spoilers, but there's French waiters who will literally bend over backwards for characters and how they move, and how that exaggeration is, you know, there's a functionality to this exaggeration. And most importantly, there's a logic to it. So that's the thing, is we're not just doing things for silly sake. It has to kind of make sense. So I believe, for instance, you know, in the squat clubfoot heroine of this story, that not only would she, but she could kind of cross massive and dangerous barriers in the pursuit of her grandchild, because there's an internal logic that kind of governed her story throughout the film, and her relentless and selflessness, and her wanting nothing more to see her grandchild happy. And, you know, she's mm-hmm. trying to introduce him to different hobbies. Obviously, he's a little morose and withdrawn, and he's lost his parents. So trying to get him interested. And when she does get him interested in something, and in this case, it's the bike, you know, she's kind of putting herself in danger to even kind of coach him and really kind of push him in a way to kind of push himself to kind of compete for the Tour de France. So that's in the macro, of what her character is about. In the really micro bit of like giving a character logic and how they'll function for the rest of the story, it can be seen for me in Bruno's character, who we understand hates trains, and at a very young age had an incident where his tail falls victim to a track. And from then on, we know two things about Bruno: A, that he loves his human champion, he loves food, and he hates trains. And that kind of governs the rest of his behavior for the entirety of the film. That makes it, you can do outsized things with him, but it makes sense. So it's in many touches like these that I'm a big fan of Sylvian's work, and the morose logic kind of vibe is what I'm really attracted to in the exaggeration. So this is your first time watching this film. I'm really, really excited to get your immediate reaction and your take on some of this more weird, acid dreamy kind of French films here, animated French films.
I loved everything you said there, and you hit on some of the things that I'm gonna hit on in this too, with my immediate reaction coming out of my first viewing. You know, this movie, you know, all about rhythm and bodies and texture. And I think one of the things that stood out to me, like you said, animated films like this and also like dialogue light movies can have a tendency to start to feel like a series of vignettes or a series of set pieces. Mm-hmm. And this movie is it's narratively well constructed. It's, you know, there's a lot of depth to it that I picked up on a rewatch in the week, but it's still, everything is there and everything is clear. And it moves along at a nice pace where it never feels like it's experimental, but it's very grounded in its storytelling. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I appreciated a lot. That said, I wish this movie loved anything as much as it hates fat people. I wish that this movie found anything enjoyable as much as it enjoyed just leering at large bodies. It's not as unpleasant as a back massage with a lawnmower, but it's not for a lack of trying. But yeah, there's a lot to love in this movie, but like, and I think that what you'd said about the kind of the melancholic nature of it, you know, if you can appreciate that and that doesn't scare you away from this movie, then there's a lot of beauty to be observed and beheld in this movie. But yeah, it's just, there's not a lot of joy in this movie. Even when you mentioned, you know, two things about the dog, that he loves his owner and he hates trains. I'm like, does he love his owner?
Yeah, I would say loyalty is a big part of that character. And there's what he's willing to, you know, so
there's just not a lot of love. There's a lot of loyalty and a lot of like putting your nose to the grindstone, right, and doing the work and persistence and perseverance. Mm-hmm. And those can be ways that love is depicted, or love is, mm-hmm, love is expressed. But man, I just want to see some people smile just like once.
I like that take.
I will say though, my dog loved this movie. I have a mutt of a bunch of different kind of shepherd sheepdogs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And she actively watches television and movies with me, especially if there's an animal on the screen. And she absolutely loved this movie.
Yeah,
so I might put this on for her at some point in the future.
I like that.
Who else do you think has this Blu-ray on the shelf? I know this is an influential film for a lot of people.
Sure. And I think there's a few that leap to mind. I think the easy answer is, are you familiar with the films of Jean-Pierre Jeunet? I don't know if that's a Delicatessen or Amelie. The fourth Alien, Alien Resurrection, one where Sigourney Weaver like throws a basketball behind her head. And Ron Perlman, he did that. That was his. He has that same sense of being able to capture somebody in a very quick moment in the styling of their clothing or their behavior or just their pose. And that's another French director. The one that I think that is kind of more in my like crime noir telling that I like is an early Guy Ritchie. You know what I mean? I'm sure that this maybe appeals to him. In his heyday, he was excellent at distilling characters in heightened universes. So, you know, I'm thinking Snatch, I'm thinking Lock Stock. Do you know what I mean? Like there's very small vignettes of characters that he has to get across, like everything about their personality and just, you know, a pose or a shot or and really excited. I like his loved his ability to do that. So I think those are two filmmakers.
He has good vignettes or silhouettes of characters. Yeah. Like you got different physicalities and right, the way that people move and stuff. Like,
right.
Yeah, you're right. He does have a good, it's tough to direct an ensemble like that. And it's really, that is one of the ways that if you have a big ensemble cast, like you have to be good at
making
a character pop in a very small amount of time. For me, I think Lord and Miller, the Kingpin design is like a pretty obvious homage to this. I was most familiar with this movie. Like, I wasn't familiar with the like title or the name of the filmmaker offhand, mm-hmm, but then watching it, I was like, oh yeah, this is the one that everybody references. Mm-hmm. Like
the King.
I think there's a podcast I listen to, Rude Tales of Magic. It's a D&D podcast, mm-hmm, that is a bunch of the people on it are like animators, and Carly Minato worked on Venture Brothers and a bunch of other animated shows and stuff. And then the guy who DMs it is Branson Reese, who does Swan Boy. And I feel like their art style isn't necessarily in the same art style, but the sense of humor I can definitely see.
Is that right?
In the kind of like the humor coming from the bodies and the physicality and the mm-hmm. way that of like in the character design even. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, that those two in particular on that, that podcast are, have a background in. So I guarantee that it's on their shelf.
I love that.
Kill the wabbit. I've heard some corny birds who tried to sing. Still, the cat's the only cat who knows how to swing.
All right, we're coming back from the break now. From here on out, we'll be spoiling the film in our focus group segment. Starting off with Eric, what scene would you show someone to get them to watch?
My favorite bit, and I think if you're tonally in line with this film, this is the one that's going to appeal to you. It's Madame Suzeau finding the spark while the Industrial Revolution of France is sort of encroaching on her home. So these two things, I think, are the dichotomy of the film. And it's her finding a bond with her grandson, a journey of discovery. It exemplifies what I love most about this film, and it's the mood. And she does find something for, you know, her grandchild who is sullen. He's lost his parents at this point. They find a way to connect over a bike. But as this sort of warmth is happening, this darkness is sort of encroaching in on her home, literally tipping it aside at one point and into a shot we'll talk about later in the episode. But it's this sort of back and forth that's the running theme in Comey's work. It's the artist's attempt to thrive in poverty through an ever-changing world and how they adjust to that. We're not going to talk about it on this episode, but there is another film I'm going to make you watch down the line, and it's the second animated feature, The Illusionist, which is really deals really heavy in the morose in this theme in particular. So this is
I knew another one was coming down the line, and I was like, I wonder, like, because I really like this, but as I, you know, mentioned before, it was just like it's a dour film.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I really hope this second movie that he's making me watch is just like a teensy bit.
Oh no. It's even sadder than this.
No.
That's what makes this work so beautiful to me.
Right. I'll work it up. I'll work up the
when I get the megrims again, that's the one we're gonna throw we'll throw on. How about you, Sean? What scene would you show to get somebody to watch?
I went with the sniffing out the mob bar. It had a bit of the some great character work. You called out the waiter who just cannot keep his head upright because he's just bending over backwards so much.
Literally spineless.
Yeah, just the physicality of everybody as they're moving through that scene is a lot of fun. And then you get the musical sequence with Madame Suzeau joining the triplets on stage. So you get the musical element, too. So I felt like that was the scene that, you know, we talk about all the elements coming together in a way that like kind of would be a great way to pitch the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
What did you catch in this viewing that you hadn't noticed before?
There's a few things. One, Madame Suzeau, after she gets done introducing the piano to him and then Champion sort of runs upstairs crying, I never noticed that she hits the key like the dum, after she fails. God, that made me laugh.
That's a good bit. That's a good bit.
Yeah.
I had the first time I watched it, I didn't catch like what was going on with the alarm clock Rube Goldberg machine
For the food.
Yeah, for the food. And then when I was rewatching it, getting ready for the podcast, I finally spotted that he was sitting on the scale.
Yeah.
And so it was like him just eating the right amount of food until the alarm goes off. And so that it clicked afterwards, but I was like, what is there's a lot of build up to it. And then I had to like go back and remember what was going on. It was presented in a strange way that confused me, but
I like that. There's a couple. Let me hit you with one and two of the last things I've noticed in doing the research for this film this week. I had seen Comey's short film in the past. It's a short film about pigeons, what I hadn't noticed is the character from that short film makes a brief cameo in Triplets, and it's the forgiven for missing it, but it's where she finally makes it to the end of the Tour de France, and they're kind of driving into town, and she notices the broom wagon, the one that the mafia was driving, the car that's stuck in the tunnel, and all the cops are there trying to like get it out. One of the cops is the character from the short film.
Cool.
So that was interesting when I saw him pop up today. So Sylvian Comey, and a little bit of his background is, he worked for Disney at a time, worked for Disney, I believe in Quebec or Montreal, somewhere in Canada, and just had a real rough go of it. And I'll quote him here. He says, when I arrived, they were working on the sequel to Hercules, says Comey, quote, the atmosphere was bizarre. They had such a cynical way of thinking. I came in and said, I can do some designs. And they said, the mimics of a cynical person. Okay, yeah, that's fine. When I worked there, I realized what not to do on a feature film. They have this mentality that they're trying to do quote-unquote product. They don't make films anymore. It's like they do advertisements now. People are very talented there, but there's no soul. So he had a real, I guess, when you want to kind of do more of this experimental work, Disney wasn't really there at that point in time. So there's a lot of anti-Disney bits in this film. So for one, the mechanic that builds the mafia machine is an amalgamation of Walt and Mickey. So he kind of has Walt Disney's face, but he looks like Mickey Mouse a little bit.
Yeah, a little mousy guy.
Yeah, exactly.
They even show the little Polaroids of him going,
to Disneyland, with the sucker.
And then everybody laughs at him.
Also, when we're going into the triplets' home and they're living in that dilapidated building, they cross a toilet with some shit in it. And the shit is like styled in Mickey Mouse's. It has like the silhouette of the mouse.
Wow. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, so a couple things in there that I had noticed on this viewing.
That's funny. I liked that in the opening bit, like the passage of time being depicted by the dog getting fatter. is a pretty solid bit. It's just like, you know, in a movie with very few words, choosing to how you depict certain things and doing it, getting an extra joke out of it is always clever.
Right. Absolutely.
Is there something that you have come to forgive that annoyed, bothered you?
I think the first time that I saw it, I was in college. This is, a real early, animation student pick. You know what I mean? This is the first, I believe, French animated film that was nominated for an Oscar in 2003. So I wasn't as familiar with Josephine Baker, and that's the black caricature that they have at the beginning of the film that does the banana dance. Now, I wasn't as familiar with since then. I've become familiar with Josephine Baker, who was adopted by the French. Is a black actress and performer. She had a famous skit called The Banana Dance, which is very much to what he's caricaturing in this film. It's not the greatest because obviously Sylvian has like real strong takes about, Americans. There are very few people of color in his films. So I'm not really sure the sensitivity would be there to depict them well.
Yeah.
But I would be curious to see how other people in different races are styled in his films, in his style. I'm just genuinely curious about how he would do that.
Nobody looks great.
Which I prefer.
Even the people who are supposed to be like celebrities and movie stars on TV are depicted in ways that look
really
like
grotesque ways.
Exactly. So it is just like seems like a person that is like, oh, I just hate everyone equally. Right. So I'm not racist. And it's like, well, that still sucks.
I feel you, Comey. Anyway,
I understand the sentiment, but it's like it doesn't make you any less guilty.
Yeah, very true. Also, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Sylvain was accused of plagiarism by artist Nicolas. I'm going to butcher your last name, Nicolas. I apologize, but Nicolas Decree. I'm
going to go with. Put some sauce on it, and then at least.
Nicolas was a artistic partner and I believe a somewhat mentor to Sylvian earlier in his career. We're going to link in the show notes the book that he created, that the styling for Triplets of Belleville was heavily influenced by. Now, I'm not one to completely dismiss an artist for heavy adoption or influence from another source. Tarantino, we talk a lot of. Paul Thomas Anderson, obviously, would be another one. Martin Scorsese, you know, people kind of in conversations with different films and referencing different things and using different motifs from 100 different things that you haven't seen before in their own work to sort of comment or using their own styling. I'm able to sort of forgive this, but I'm curious on your position. I know I'm kind of hitting you this, you know, unprepared, but what is your sort of position for artists in that fashion, like using to what you would call a And Tarantino does get that a lot, the plagiarist kind of
bit and a lot. Cameron talks a lot about it too, because he's stopped, like he says everything came to him in a dream because he's afraid of like getting sued for plagiarism.
Right.
And you know, obviously like Avatar looks like fucking Roger Dean covers, like it's very obvious like that he's taking inspiration from these things and remixing it and telling his own story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there's a I think there's a level of remixing that maybe you're obligated to do, and maybe the less remixing that you do, the more money that you should be coughing up to the original artist.
Mm-hmm.
And this definitely, like, you linked the article to me already, and I was flipping through it, and this definitely feels like a case where it's like you had a close working relationship with the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And these are pretty one-to-one comparisons. And I mean, obviously, like I said, like he took all these, even if he's taking inspiration for these still images and tying them together into an animated work that is narratively coherent over 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like he took it and he ran with it. It's not saying like, oh, he just stole that work and, you know, took it out of his hands and put it on the page and got paid for it. Like it's not that simple, but I think you also have to admit, like, if it's somebody that you're close with and it looks so heavily influenced by it, like, maybe you should have, this should have been something where you brought this guy in and fucking paid him.
Fair point. Like, absolutely fair. Was there something you didn't understand about the film?
I don't understand. I looked up some, because, you know, obviously there's like some mixed 2D, 3D. You know, they're doing a lot of the vehicles in 3D. And then there's some, like, the water stuff. Obviously the bicycles and, like, the minutiae of, like, the mechanics and stuff. Like, you're rotating a mechanical object in 3D space. Like, that makes sense. That stuff didn't really bother me.
Mm-hmm.
The 3D water really bothered me.
Interesting.
It just looked it aged. It looks like it's going to age very poorly.
It has. I won't.
And
yeah,
it and the, like you called out the opening sequence. What'd you call it? A banana dance.
Yeah.
Like the contrast between like the objectification of the bodies that he's doing in the other scenes, and then the shortcuts in the 3D. Is just like a why include the ocean as such a large part of your movie if you weren't interested in animating water?
I will. I'm of two minds. I hear what you're saying. I think at the time, and if I'm trying to remember my first reaction to it, I think it was a little bit more favorable because just, you know, at that point in time, that just was what was. You know, the latest and greatest in terms of technology didn't really bother you so much at the time. Now you're definitely right. It did age poorly, but I think the sentiment that Comey was getting at, as sort of an olive branch to his animators, as you said, you know, the minutiae of animating wheels and gears and cars. Yeah. That's a lot. Water, for instance, it's long, it's tedious. Water and wind, grass, things of this nature, depending on how, you know, the complexity. Like the things that you're mentioning with Akira that was, you know, completely drawn, these are things that take years and years of development. Yeah. And you have to have a real patient hand for somebody to do that over and over. So I think him sort of extending the branch of, we'll do some of this stuff that isn't as interesting to animate. you know, we'll take a little bit of the hit of it not maybe aging. I'm not sure if he was thinking that way at the time. Maybe he just thought, well, this looks great. You know, this is what we got. So not anticipating that it would age poorly.
I looked up part of it, and I saw a quote on him saying, like, specifically, like, the water explosion when one of the sisters is fishing for frogs with dynamite.
Yeah.
That he had saying like, oh, like, we just, like, couldn't get that to look the way we wanted, so we decided to go with 3D in it. And it's like, really, no one's done water explosion before?
Sure, like, maybe in the styling, that because he does, which is unique, is there's still the and this is at a time too in the Pixar revolution of everyone kind of fleeing 2D animation. This is sort of the revolt of that, or so to do some of the cross-hatching or make the things feel as if they're still in the styling of Kome's drawing isn't necessarily as and to kind of create that dimensionality to it is necessarily as easy at the at that point in time, that, you know, as opposed to now. So I think I'm a little bit more forgiving, but I do appreciate that. I see what you're saying. Like it is something that would that could annoy you, definitely.
Being kind to your team is something I can always appreciate. It that does actually lead me into this into our next segment, though.
Nice.
Which is in Grover Cleveland's Presidential Time Machine. This was what you had just said about the, like, Pixar moving away from 2D animation. I was thinking about if this film works in a different decade. I almost feel like this film is in the exact wrong point in history, where if it was in the 70s or 80s, it would have been more subversive.
Okay.
And if it was made in the last decade, we would have been like, oh, the 2D hand animation, and really lavished over it.
That was my exact answer. I feel like if it came out today, it would be way more. It would be celebrated. Yeah. I think. Yeah, like this is.
Exactly.
And it was an awards darling. Obviously, it was nominated for an Oscar, so it got some. But I think even now today, it would be a way bigger. Like, wow.
I agree. Yeah, that's totally.
A priest, a Buddhist, and a rabbi walk out of this film. Sean, how do they judge it? Particularly, how do you think the animals were treated in this film?
You mentioned that kind of
got to you a little bit as far as the love between Bruno and Champion.
Oh, I mean, I just feel like there's very this movie has a very suffering focused lens. Like, even the way that love is expressed is through, like, you know, perseverance and like stubbornness more so than like compassion or warmth. And
wait,
so
is that an option? I'm sorry.
Rough. But yeah, you get, this definitely comes from a like redemptive suffering. I think you like whatever, like Baptist is like kind of what I associate that with. But it's just not a philosophy that I identify with, or that it's honestly a philosophy that I struggle with in general, of this, like, I don't even know what am I trying to say.
Me? Like that kind of feeling.
It's like, it's both sides of the coin, where there's like one side of the coin is the woe is me, and the other side of the coin is, well, that's just life, sonny, suck it up. And it's like, well, both of those suck. Like, and I feel like, I don't know which side of it is this movie's really on, but it feels like it's one of those two sides. Right. I don't know. That's I didn't really say anything interesting there, but.
No, I think that I like that. That's pretty good. I like that.
Okay. Did you have anything for that one, or
no? That was, I was setting you up for that one. Yeah, because I thought you were gonna. I really thought the one criticism you were gonna nail in on is like him getting used for like a spare tire, like Bruno at one point, or like some of the animal treatment. This feels like, oh, this is something that he's gonna. So
the humans get treated just as shitty as the animals. That's like, it's not. They don't single out the animals as being treated poorly. It's like, everyone is just slogging through existence.
But there is a little bit of joy. Well, you know, we'll there's a little bit of joy with the sisters and how they're thriving in their environment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, and Champion, I think, in his own way, and I think this is interesting too, because you brought this up about First Man and not seeing a lot of joy in mm-hmm. Ryan Gosling's character or in Chazelle's characterization in general. I think there is a certain amount of joy that introverts in that way, and I'm talking about Champion and his survival, and mm-hmm. And Gosling and sort of the back and forth with Claire Boy, that they bring to their performances, that it's very subtle, but it is there. It's maybe not detectable and as warm as a Hallmark film, but it's definitely, there's definitely some moments, some very touching moments.
Oh yeah, I can see that. It's just not something I'm like, man, I want to be around that more. Like, I don't know.
That Eeyore kind of shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's throw it to a break.
Oh, listen, we don't have much time. The algorithms, they're too strong. They're coming for us. Our takes, too hot. Our swag, too different. It's all up to you now. Make Me Watch needs you. We need you to send an episode to a friend. Yes, you! Do it! We can't rely on the machines anymore. We have to grow the old-fashioned way. One by one.
All right, back from the break. We're going under the lights, breaking down our favorite performances. what do you got for us, E? What do you got? I know you wanted to call some stuff in this.
I did. So performance-wise, I think can be difficult to detect for the layman in an animated film because you're not necessarily keying in on it in the same way that you would be if you're looking at, I don't know, Leonardo DiCaprio or Sidney Sweeney.
A traditional animated film, like, the performance would be split between the voice actor and the animator, right? Like,
very true.
Animators.
Robin Williams is definitely going to give an animator something to work with, and based on your relationship to Robin Williams' behavior and his work.
And the animator is in charge of, like, making sure that the animated performance is, like, matching up with that voice performance. So it's like really like they both have a hand on the ball of the character.
Absolutely.
This is an interesting movie. I want to hear you talk more about though, because it's like, yeah, it's like it is all on the animator because there's not really much of a voice performance here.
Yeah. So you're going to, as an animator, depending on your styling, your certain flavor, the certain thing that you're bringing to it. For instance, there's animators famous in the Disney house. Glenn Keane was one of these animators who was one of his more famous sequences is the Beast fight in Beauty and the Beast. When you see his work, there's a fluidity to his work, and there's a very cinematic and exaggerated fluidity to how he moved the beast in that character.
Yeah, very like animalistic and non-human. Like he does a good job of representing the physicality. Like we talk about actors that have like great physical performances.
Exactly.
Like he's an animator that does a great physical performance.
Certainly. I had a mentor in college, Dave Pruxma, who was called the King of Cute at Disney, and he would animate, you know, like Flounder or the Sultan characters, very round, very bubbly kind of characters. And when you meet Dave Pruxma, it's like, that is who that guy is. he's kind of shaped like these characters in a certain way. He kind of behave like
he's friend shaped.
Yeah. He's a very, you know, very upbeat, positive kind of guy. And so these performances that who these people are and how they bring these, you know, these performances to their work comes out through the pencil and comes out through this performance. So when we see the character designs of like Madame Suzo and her relentlessness, but you know, the things that still sort of hinder her, I find to be really interesting. And I'm wondering where that comes out in Sylvian's character. So she has a club foot a little bit. She's very short, you know, dour kind of woman. A hint of a mustache there. She's not a very beautiful person. She's a bit of an eye that's either a glass eye or it's a little loose. That every time she's adjusting her glasses, her eye is sort of rolling around in her head. But she loves her grandson. And she's again, relentless in... And seeing him happy and seeing him kind of fulfill his desires. So things like that come out of who the personality of Sylvain Comey is. Similar to the design of the mafia, and like Sean called out, we see a lineage of that in Kingpin's design. for the Spider-Verse films, but the boxy monolithic shape that these guys take, and they're all sort of uniform, they all kind of blend into one another, and they all kind of meld into one kind of being that they're sort of there's no distinction between any of the characters. They all just feel the same as a mob would, as a horde would. Mm-hmm. I just love that sense of how he distills what it means to be in a mafia family to those shapes.
Do you when know they
what
I mean? Turn into each other, each other. Right. It's so disorienting and weird, but like, it's a choice.
Or the boss himself, literally being enveloped by his bodyguards, like not having a body himself, being protected by these two shades. It's just really interesting stuff like that.
That's super cool. Is there a best bit in particular? Like we usually do line reads, so like what's a gag? What is your favorite gag?
So I went, when I said bit, I guess I was thinking sequence.
Oh, okay. I was thinking bite size, like a line would, you know.
So I'm going to.
I'll let you cook on that, because the only one I wrote down, I love when the frog gets freed from the Tripwoods apartment and immediately jumps onto the tracks and gets splatted by the train. That felt very emblematic of this film's mood as a whole, of the pessimism and fatality of everything.
I'm going to go with Bruno getting up at the exact 15 minutes or every half hour to go bark at the train and then coming back down to wait and see when Suzo and Champion have returned. So I love that the internal clock that he has in his head that he knows when he needs to get upstairs to start barking.
That was the one I should have written down in the thing I didn't understand before, but what was the Bruno seeing the guy that looks kind of like a dog then switching places with him in his dreams or whatever. That was a very weird. I really appreciated how just strange and out of nowhere that was. And that was probably one of the only things in the film that I'm still kind of grappling with. I don't know, you have any?
Well, obviously the train is a big point of contention with Bruno, and how that injured him so early in his youth. And I think it's his just learning what it would be like from the train's perspective, or it's sort of because there's two dream sequences. At another point he dreams that Champion has the horse collar on him, and he's being sort of in a pulley system around his bowl at some point, and it pulls out for around his bowl. So he in some way has prophetic dreams about trains and his relationships to them. And
then Muad'Dib. Muad'Dib!
Lisa Nadiv. that's Bruno's that's his fixation, his train. So I think just simply put, it was his just him viewing it from the other perspective.
The guy, I'm like, what the fuck is going on with that guy?
And the people look like their dogs kind of feel, thing like this. So I think it was a reference or commentary on people looking like their animals or looking like their dogs.
It was interesting though. I loved it. Did you have a sequence that you wanted to talk about?
So I feel like the Tour de France is one of my favorite just bits of life in the film. So some more of the joyous. I know we're talking about this movie being a bit more dour. There are a few sequences of just life and celebration. I think part of that is the French's relationship to cycling and the Tour de France as a sport. So some of the families that are out there with their wine and cheese and just celebrating the cyclists as they're going on. Some people watching it in their vans. I love the sun-baked, washed out yellows that are used in that scene.
The watercolor warm tones are the color work in this film in general is absolutely perfect.
So some of that life of just people hanging around taking pictures,
until the bicyclists turn into zombies, then it gets weird. But that's such a creepy character design.
The horse kind of
when they're just wheezing. Gaunt oh, it's so creepy.
I love that.
But that scene is very yeah, just more. It is the warmest that this movie gets. You're right.
What performance would you like to pick up and drop in another movie, McGee?
I think every movie would be improved by an absurdly fat dog. I think that just like I can't imagine a movie that would be worse because it had a fat dog.
I love me some fat dogs.
It's always good. Always love a fat dog.
For me, I love the strong-willed mother roles, and I'm curious how Madame Suzo would work in like Kill Bill or like Panic Room or something like that. Protecting Champion.
What was Nobody? That was Bob Odenkirk's
star. Yeah.
We need like a granny version of Nobody.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Yeah, that's a good shit. RZA making another voice cameo in there.
I'm trying to think who would be a good like 70-year-old action star.
Helen Mirren, it seems like she's kind of taking that. Ooh, like, you know, yeah. Real, I mean, she fun, did the Fast and Furious. She did the Shazam film.
She was in that Red with Bruce Willis back in the day.
She did the spinoff from Fast and Furious too.
She was in that one?
Yeah, she's their mom, or she's Jason Statham's mom. Yeah, so she likes to have a lot of fun, you know, in her role. But I would want... Honestly, I would
Susan
want...
Sarandon. Someone. Susan Sarandon would be a fun one.
See, I was trying to get away from the statuesque. Like, who's a more like?
Oh, like a tiny.
Yeah, who's somebody that's like a little like.
That's a good one.
Like character actor Margot Martindale, who's like, I don't know if you
Margot Martindale would be dope. I would watch an action movie with Margot Martindale. That rips. Yeah. Let's get it in production.
I love it.
John Wick, starring Margot Martindale, rules. Love it.
If you were dropped in the shoes of the main character, Sean, how does it play out from there? I'm basically asking you, would you go to the ends of the earth for somebody? Would you cross mass oceans?
No doubt. I'm stubborn to a fault, so that's I would hop on the bike and turn into a zombie. I mean, there are times I have felt like Champion in my life.
Yeah.
Just trudging forward, not sure if I'm enjoying myself anymore, if I'm just too stubborn to quit. But maybe Champion just needs to start a podcast. No.
Let's throw it to a break.
Ash, your podcaster of choice at Once Weekly Make Me Watch is right for you. Proven to reduce time spent ambling through streaming services and alleviate dull commutes. Follow along our Shot for Shot segment on your social media platform of choice with links provided in the show notes. Make me watch.
You will.
Contact us if you observe any of the following reactions upon exposure: an overwhelming desire to suggest a film, a burning need to correct our pronunciation, or excessive pocket change. Special thanks to Nick and Jay Shute, Mike from Failing Hollywood, and Adam from Pod It Together. Additional music provided by Kevin McLeod. Full credits in the show notes below.
All right, welcome back from break. We're going behind the lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and the curtain close. I'm going to pick a few shot for shots, and these are shots that stood out to me and Sean during the film. You can follow along this segment on our socials. We'll be posting them up, and you get a better idea, sort of a companion piece to what we enjoyed about this film. I'm going to kick us off here. My shot takes place 34 minutes and 53 seconds into the film. It's Madame Suzo and Bruno climbing the stairs after they get into port. Now, it's a wide shot.
Classic.
And it's a one-point perspective, and it's a real upward tilt. Yeah, these are things that I like a lot. But I think, it appeals to a very, I don't know what it is. I like scale, and I like, I like putting, you know, just, A, I like scale. B, her place in the story of she's just at this point just traversed a massive body of water on a pedal bike, you know, for her grandson. We're expecting her, I think, to get to the end of her journey, and yet she still has to climb this massive amount of stairs. She still has a little, something, you know, to add to the dour theme of this film and the morose nature.
It sets up the city really well, too, because it's like the city's just like immediately looming over everything.
Right.
I think it's a really good sense of... like you said, just scale and distance and perspective,
right,
with the you know, you described like the way that the camera is positioned and tilted. And it's like, I think that's one of the things that is great about the cinematography of this like animated movie, is that it's always thinking about like the lens and the camera in this animated space.
Yes. Can I also say too, the ship and the ocean liner, excuse me, and their design is one absolutely top three favorite designs of this film, period. I love these massive tower ships that are on these small bodies that then sort of envelop like a vase, or sort of the contour of the shape is sort of like a vase. Love the design of these ships.
They mirror the way that people are like absurdly skinny and then like absurdly wide, and they look like they're about to snap off at any given point. Like everything is like fragile. Like the ships have that same like design aesthetic of like, it's like physically impossible for something to be that skinny and that wide at the same time.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. You, Sean?
My shot here, it's 38 minutes 27 seconds in. It's Madame Suzo and Bruno. Bruno?
Yes, Bruno.
Madame Suzo and Bruno taking refuge under the bridge with a little makeshift fire. I like this shot. I had thought about picking some other shots of the city because I really like the sense of scale as you kind of zoom through it a little bit. But I really like this shot because you get a lot of atmosphere and mood with where the characters are at the same time of these layers of, you know, the bridge in the foreground, the suspension bridge in the middle there that's absurdly high. You have the ships that we talked about that you get a hint of, and the cranes and everything. And then, you know, the city just rising together. I really love the design of the city. I know we called out the art director in the credits, but the architecture work alone and the way that the buildings are drawn in this film is just so gorgeous.
An amalgamation of New York and Paris and Quebec. Some other influences there too. But yes, some really interesting.
You can see the what's that, like Mont Saint Clair, I think, is the
right for the architecture for the
just the way the city's shaped, like that, like.
Well, what am I thinking of though? What would you call the silhouette for the roof?
The steeples, I guess.
Like, I guess something that I know he's taking. Yeah,
but Mont Saint Clair specifically is that, like, it's the island in France where the city is like the when the tide comes in, it's like an island, and when the tide goes out, there's a road or whatever. But it's just like super, super built up into one, and like it looks like this, like that, like kind of like pyramid of random buildings. That's what I'm getting.
Yeah, there's a, but I believe they just shot it for Equalizer 3. I believe that, or it's a take on that.
God, that was a terrible movie.
I mean, it's one of those for you. I didn't hate it, but it, dude, you know. Yeah,
it was just like, did we need it?
Yeah, we didn't need it. That's the thing.
It's the same movie.
To kill an afternoon. I was like, yeah, all right.
Yeah,
I can watch.
That movie was just titled Equalizer again in my head. It was just like
Food in there. That kind of made me really want some Italian food. Just some of the stuff that they were eating.
Oh my god, it's the opposite of this movie. The food is absolutely fucking disgusting in this entire movie. It sucks.
He does have a poor relationship with food.
He has a poor relationship with people and food and existing. Like, I just think this guy's like a bummer to be around.
That's why I love him. I love his animated work.
I love you, Eric. You are not a bummer like on this level.
When I'm in these kind of moods, we're just like, I'm just feeling like a guy like this, or just like, oh, yeah, let me just be sad.
You
in this
need
movie.
Somebody else to be even shittier than you. Well, mission accomplished.
That's why I enjoy it.
That's I love funny.
It. So this is unique. This is the first time this has happened in the show's history. Sean and I have picked the same shot. Synergy.
we've come close before.
Definitely,
we've had runner-ups and
Get
stuff
Out.
And
it sticks to mind. Yeah,
but this one I had literally the exact same frame pulled.
And this shot takes place at 8 minutes and 24 seconds into the film. It is the wide of Madame Suzo's home being tipped over by the bridge, by the train bridge that's now sort of encroached in her space, in her airspace.
Yeah.
And it's literally tipped the house over. I know why I love this shot, Sean, but I'm very curious to hear what struck you about this.
I love, so it's not just this shot, like, you know, obviously no shot exists in a vacuum, and, you know, it's anything in a still image, like, is put in the context of the movie. So I love this image in context too, where the lead up to this shot is the time lapse. You see the passage of time of this house going through the different seasons. And you see a little bit of changes through the different seasons of like, you know, like spring to or fall to winter to spring. And then it just smashes to this shot where everything is just dramatically different. And the house is tipped over and the framing is off. And it really like the emotion that it evoked out of me where I was already, I had my attention with the seasons changing and mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's like cute. That's pretty, that's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And like the way it's depicted. And then just the smash cut to like, oh shit, everything's fucked now. I knew exactly what they were trying to do and it worked and it got me. It was great.
Sean took the words right out of my mouth. I think it's similar to the vibe of I feel like thematically what Kome gets at. It's sort of thriving in these really horrific situations that I love so much. So obviously, you know, this is an ideal, but she's still making a go of it. She's still right now she's out, you know, training with Champion to get into the Tour de France. So they're still living life in the most inconvenient of circumstances. it's definitely like I said, the kind of feeling that I love from Kome's work.
Great. I love it. What's the best combination of craft in this movie? Where do the stars align for the department heads for you?
So many sequences are incredible in my opinion. We spoke again. I know the water bothers you in Madame Suzuki kind of crossing the ocean, but the mixture of using Mozart's Great Mass in C minor, like that score, the operatic feeling that sort of evokes, it hurts pedaling along. It really, like, I love the feeling of that. Like I said, I spoke about the design of the ocean liners, but I think my favorite sequences paired together, or the combination of the writing and then the performance, I'm sorry. So let me take that again. My favorite two sequences are kind of finding out like why the sisters insisted on Suzo not using any of the appliances in the house, and then yes. You realizing that they're instruments later on in their performance.
Yes.
And then the sound design for these instruments, and then the music that they create with mm-hmm. it—like that to me is just magic. And
totally I know, agree. 100% agree. That's the same thing I was going to bring really? Up. That was the same exact scene I was going to, because it is just like I remember. You know, like I kind of have a little bit of that background too, of like I played music for a while, and mm-hmm. I'm the like kind of ADD mm-hmm. Sort of person that I'm always like drumming on something or like tapping away on something, so right. I identified with that. I love that aspect of it.
Yes.
In a similar way, I think like I think that scene specifically when they finally all come together on stage, and then and like, you know, I mentioned before, that's the scene I would use to pitch, because mm-hmm. I do feel like it's when everything kind of comes together very beautifully. Mm-hmm. I do love the opening musical number with the main theme of the movie.
Oh, yeah absolutely.
It's so good. It's so yeah. funny. It sets the tone so well. I mean yeah. obviously the one segment where I was like, I don't know what's going on here. But then the tap dancer right afterwards, right. though, I have
the
to say,
is
so funny. The
being
way
eaten
he
by
like,
his own shoes.
Performatively smiles and yeah. dies yeah. and is still kind of smiling while he dies and is eaten is right. so funny. Like that's the kind of like absurd, you know, I called out Rude Tales of Magic before. Like mm-hmm. that sense of humor is something yeah. that I loved and I thought really hit really well. That opening, that's number just rules.
Absolutely. And speaking of the number, the music itself, just the music of Benoit Charis. I apologize, brother. I know we butchered that this whole episode, but like
speak
an absolute
for yourself, I nailed it.
I'm just absolute absolute banger. I love Belleville Rendezvous.
It's been in my head for the last like few days for sure.
great score. I think you marry that with some beautiful animation and you get some magic like we got in this sequence. Yeah, for sure.
You got any studio notes, anything that wasn't working for you that you want to fix?
So I think part of the vignette floating feeling, while I do love, and I mentioned that in my general notes section, the space of giving just things more of a languid pause or characters sort of just ambling around a little bit, a little plotless, is definitely something of a melancholic film that I do love. But how Suzo and the sisters meet into her finally discovering where Champion is, I'm not sure. It just kind of feels a little aimless, a little mm-hmm. too aimless. Like I guess I wanted to know what her plan was, because she loses Champion at a point in time. Then she goes to get something to eat. And then she just starts performing with the sisters. But I was like, I was thinking like in terms of the logic, like, wouldn't you be, is there something else you could have done that maybe
Bruno in the sniffs, path of the sisters?
Yeah. Or, you know what? Like maybe Bruno sniffs the hat and that brings you to the theater and maybe the sisters are there. Maybe you're in the alleyway of the, and that's how you met the sisters or something, but you were actively doing something still to look for Champion. Mm-hmm. And then you run into the sisters, and then that sort of plot line still takes. Okay. But I'm like,
that makes sense.
I didn't understand what her plan was once she lost Champion. I was like, so you're just, and because she performs for a while, it seems like, at least my reading of it, it feels like there's some time. At least she gets like the little Suzo bike.
Yeah, she gets her little drum out and her dulcimer or whatever.
So I don't know if that was the first performance or like the 13th performance. I'm not sure how long they have been performing with one another or what the. How long she had been there, what the deal was, but
yeah, that's interesting. I think I do. That was the note that I had written was like the antagonist. You know, they clear up what's going on so slowly, so it's like by the time that you know where Champion is and why they have Champion, they're already busting him out. So maybe, you know, kind of clearing up where he is would make it easier to get her there, you know what I mean?
Interesting. Like literally really, where they're being held.
Yeah, because you don't even know why he got kidnapped until she's already basically found him. Like, you know, like you see them hooked up in the basement with the projector, mm-hmm. and you're like, oh, okay, he's forcing them to ride a bike. Mm-hmm. And then you see the mousy guy building a machine. Mm-hmm. And then you see them all doing the bedding thing later. But by the time you see them doing the bedding thing, they're already like working on a plan to bust him out. So it just,
interesting.
You know what I mean? Like
I don't hate it in the way that it's structured.
Maybe we
now,
could solve both our problems. Like, okay. I'm saying if we introduced where he was and what he was doing or like mm-hmm. what the mafia's plan was earlier.
Yeah.
Then maybe you could give Madame Suzo an easier way to find him once she gets there.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't know. It wasn't anything that I felt like was a fatal flaw or anything. Like I think the plotting of this movie is honestly pretty solid and performed, you know.
Well, let me ask you this then. Did it stick the landing, like in your opinion? Did it end on a note that you were I'm curious, did you watch the after credits for this? Or did you just
the little bit with the I didn't catch it the first time. I did catch it like I just left it playing on my monitor this morning. Right. And I saw the after credits bit. I won't spoil it, I guess, if anybody hasn't watched it, because it's pretty good. It's a good gag.
But did it stick the landing for you? Did it it's a little bit of
It's a climax at the speed of the four octogenarians in it. even the cars explode lazily.
Yeah.
It's just...
It's almost like a beat before and then it explodes.
Yeah. It's everything is moving at the speed of these old women. But it's still fun and like it's enjoyable. The guns oddly stressed me out more than I was expecting to.
Where the
henchman is just driving up behind him firing at them. I'm like, how has one of them not been shot? Like, obviously they're not gonna get shot because it's not really something we're gonna deal with a bullet wound in in this movie. That'd be, I think, even a step too far for this. But I don't know.
I love how they turned and maneuvered by grabbing street poles and swinging themselves around.
The physicality is great. It is just, moving incredibly slow. But I don't think, like, if it was, like, zooming or racing, if it would be, like, more fun or more believable. Like, it works in the movie they've built.
I'm going to have to agree. Has this movie earned its place in film history, or has it been justifiably overlooked? McGee, what do you think?
I mean, we talked about it before. Like, I think this was well loved and has been well referenced and lives on in the hearts of the people. This is more of a question for you, obviously. Like, you came through school and, mm-hmm. and learned about this. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is going to be, in my opinion, like, I think. It's not just, I think it will obviously stand up for animators in the long term. But I could see this as being the type of movie, like, you know, my nieces and nephews have aged out of it at this point. I guess my two younger nieces, maybe when they get a little bit older, maybe I'll introduce them to it. But, you know, like this does feel like there's a lineage in there. Mm-hmm.
I definitely feel like it feels more for an adult audience or somebody, you know, in their teens to, you know, young 20s, mm-hmm. 30s, 40s, and in Sean Case's 50s, something in that case. So I do like, you know, the animated film for an adult audience where it built and not necessarily adult content, but it's more of like an adult yeah. mood piece or
not dick jokes, but like,
yeah,
mature.
You know, yeah. So where you can deal in some of these, you know, these more like when I'm in this kind of mood, I like some more of these morose kind of films in this styling. So, I feel like it's like, you just mentioned and just to spring off of it, when I think there's more of an appetite for 2D animated films, we're seeing a lot of that with, you know, Spider-Verse is obviously heralded is there's a blend there, but it's obviously leaning heavily on the 2D nature of a drawing or what that mm-hmm. would look like in that sort of space. And it is obviously turning and we are getting a 3D perspective on these objects and how they're, you know, making cross hatches look like shadows and blend that across the character is brilliant stuff. But they are really harkening back to like, what would this feel like if it was drawn? So I think there's just an appetite for that now.
Totally.
So it could, I'd love to see an audience maybe reclaim this. There's another site that we're going to include in the show notes that, it's called Make Mine Criterion. No affiliation with us, but the guy that imagines like what a Criterion edition for films that have not yet, you know, been granted the Criterion treatment for. So he writes the show bills and like what would the special features be, and he has a lot of interesting like articles and things related to this film that we'll include here that I was reading from my research for this film this week. That I think I want another audience. I hope there's maybe a Criterion release or an Arrow Films kind of release, or somebody kind of, you know, gets some new interviews and it's presented for a new audience. So I like it. I think there's an appetite for it.
I think so too. Yeah,
for sure.
So
for
thank
sure.
you for thank you for bringing this, because it's not something I would ever been able or thought to put on. So right. I'm happy that I watched it for sure. Hell, I'm excited to get into the next one.
Let's hear it.
Coming this April to video stores everywhere.
All right. So I mean, let's play our game here. Guess the log line.
Yeah.
We need some
theme music for this.
All right, so guess the log line. We are going with, oh shit, I didn't write down the year. I think it was, is it 94 or 95? Okay. All right, guess the log line. Next week we are covering Sam Raimi's 1995, The Quick and the Dead.
All right.
Do you want to? I mean, The Quick and the Dead, Sam Raimi, Western.
Wait, Sam Raimi can't be one of the clues.
Well, I mean, it's like.
But does it help me out with the plot? I know the director, I know the tone and the vibe.
Okay. So we got The Quick and the Dead, Western, female lead.
Give me the title as a clue.
Okay? I gotta give you three. I'm. You female asked for lead, too many clues.
Genre, something like a bar, a cattle ranch.
I
the Calvary.
So you have no idea what the plot of this movie
not at all.
Is. Then. Okay.
not
well,
at all.
I mean that's the fun of the game is knowing how much you know about the plot of the movie.
Okay. Quick and the Dead. Let me make something up. Female lead. Quick and the Dead. That's the thing is like the two clues are just Western and Sam Raimi. It's like I have nothing to go. Like a female lead could do anything.
So make it up.
In the movie Quick and the Dead, our heroine is defending her plot. Her husband has died. She's defending her land from an encroaching group of cattle rustlers.
See, I mean, you went with a standard Western cowboy plot. It's honestly a good guess, but wrong. I'll read you the log line here from IMDb. It is a female gunfighter returns to a frontier town where a dueling tournament is being held, in which
like
she
that.
Enters in an effort to avenge her father's death.
Okay. I like that.
We got it stars Sharon Stone, Gene Hackman, and Russell Crowe.
Okay.
With a little baby-o Leonardo DiCaprio in it.
And, is that
it's
right?
It's a solid movie. I had a feeling that you hadn't watched this one. And I remember loving this movie as a kid so much, so I'm excited to get into this one.
Yeah, Quick in the Dead next week, brother.
Next week.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplybox, theme song by Soul Spy. Coming soon, folks.